As soon as I met Eric, I knew that he was special. I could see the kindness in his eyes. After 7 years of a marriage to a total monster, I was desperate for a man who would treat me right. Eric was that man. We met at a coffee shop. He caught me glancing at him and took the initiative to walk over and introduce himself. He was a businessman who just moved to the city. We spent hours talking in that coffee shop. The more time I spent with him, the more I knew I wanted him in my life. We were so happy together. The only problem was is that he had to travel for work a lot. Every time he left, my heart broke a little. One day, after 6 months of dating, he said that he was going to Oman for a 4-day trip. He'd never gone to the Middle East, and at least not since we were together, and I was worried about his safety. He assured me that everything was going to be okay. I had nothing to worry about. He was supposed to fly back on Sunday, but he never got on the plane. I asked everyone at the airline, but they couldn't help. I thought about going to the police, but I knew that Eric wouldn't want me to. There were things about his business that were maybe not entirely legal, though he never told me the specifics. A week went by, and I was finally ready to get the authorities involved. That's when Eric texted me. He said that someone was holding him hostage and demanding a $100,000 ransom. He told me that he was safe for now, but he needed the full amount within 2 months. He told me that I couldn't tell the police, and then he'd be able to pay me back as soon as he came back to America. That afternoon, I wired my entire savings to the account number that he sent me. It covered about 2/3, but I still needed more. I borrowed from my sisters, not telling them the reason. Then I sold every valuable thing that I owned. I donated plasma. I sold my hair to a wig shop. I took out high interest loans and did everything I could until finally, I raised the amount. Within a week before the deadline, I wired the last of the money. Eric immediately called me to say that he was released. He was flying home that afternoon. Once again, I waited at the airport for his arrival, and once again, he never showed up. I called him dozens of times, but he never answered. That's when I finally went to the police, explained everything. The officer took a bunch of notes and listened to everything I said. Then he gave me the bad news. "Ma'am, it looks like you've been a victim to a scam." I didn't believe him at first, but then he showed me a stack of files of other women falling victim to the same scheme. Eric never loved me. He just wanted my money. I thought my ex-husband was cruel, but this was the single cruelest thing anyone could ever do to a person. I felt nauseous. The officer was very sympathetic, though. He promised to track down Eric and recover as much of the stolen money as possible. I gave him all the information, but most of it wasn't helpful. Eric had lied to me about everything, including his name. He wouldn't even let me take photos of him, supposedly because of his job. However, Eric didn't know that I actually did take a photo of him. Just one, while he was sleeping on my couch. At the time, I thought he looked adorable, and I couldn't help myself. It was supposed to be just for me, so I could have something to remind me of him. The police matched it with an ex-con from out of state. It took them a couple weeks, but they arrested him at some motel with his girlfriend. Well, they tried to arrest him. He managed to escape, but his girlfriend was taken in and his accounts were frozen. I was able to recover about 60% of what was taken, enough to pay back my loans and add a little bit to my savings. But I still lost about $40,000. And the worst part about it is, I never got any closure. Eric was out there, still scamming women like me. I tried to move on, but I just couldn't. I had this ball of anger inside that wouldn't go away. After a month of wallowing in that anger, I finally figured out what I needed to do. I went to the prison where his girlfriend Shelley was being held. She still loved Eric, but she refused to cooperate with the police. She'd rather spend the extra 10 years behind bars than offer any information. When I saw her behind the glass, all I felt was pity. I could see the lovesick look in her eyes, and I knew that he manipulated her just like he manipulated me. I tried to reason with her, but she wouldn't listen. So I started recounting all the things Eric had told me in our short time together. all the compliments, all the statements of love. I quoted him word for word, hoping that she'd say that he said the same things. Slowly, I was breaking through, until one final comment managed to convince her. You know that saying, "My heart skips a beat"? I didn't understand how real it was until I met you. Shelley's face went blank. Eric used the same line on her. It's 413 Harding Street, Columbus, Ohio. I'm ready to give the information over to the police, so hurry before they get there. I went to the address, of course. I drove all night, and when I arrived, it was just a normal-looking house on a suburban street. I snuck in through the window and found Eric sleeping on a mattress on the floor. He looked peaceful and happy. He didn't hear me light the match. This story is inspired from a real-life event. In 2024, a Connecticut woman named Janet revealed her hidden tale of love and betrayal. She met a man calling himself John Gilbert at the Bristol post office, where their brief romance began. Claiming to work on a ship in the Gulf of Mexico, he charmed Janet into believing he loved her. Soon, he sent desperate, threatening messages, saying he needed money to return home safely. Out of fear and affection, Janet sent him nearly $100,000, often going hungry herself. When the truth emerged, her fairy tale turned into a nightmare. Heartbroken and penniless, Janet reported the romance scam to the police.
Dakota and I were best friends. My mom always said she was a bad influence, and in a way, I agreed with her. But she was still my friend. Sure, she gave me my first joint and introduced me to some sketchy people. And sure, she convinced me to help her shoplift a few times. But whatever, nobody's perfect. Even if we did some stuff that was technically illegal, I always knew she had my back. Last month, I was scrolling through Instagram and saw an ad for a fashion show that was coming to our town that weekend. They were looking for participants who could model their own designs. The winning designer got an internship at a pretty famous clothing company. I won't tell you which one, but you've definitely heard of it. I couldn't believe it. This was my big break. I always wanted to be a fashion designer, but I didn't have enough money to go to college. If I won this competition, I could finally get out of our crappy little town. I told Dakota right away and she was super supportive. I thought she'd be sad to think that I'd move away, but she really wasn't. She wanted me to live my dream. I showed her the outfit I was planning to wear, but she said there was something missing.
You need high quality makeup to go along with it. That's the only thing missing.
I thought my own makeup wasn't too bad, but she insisted we go to Regency, the expensive makeup store downtown. Neither of us had enough money to buy anything from that place, so I knew right away what she was suggesting. She wanted us to shoplift. I wasn't comfortable with that. We were very close to getting caught last time. But Dakota insisted. She assured me it was the only way for me to win. We waited until the afternoon rush, when we knew that the place would be packed. Dakota went straight to the makeup counter while I headed to the center of the store. Once she gave me a nod, I started choking and collapsed onto the ground.
Oh God, she's having an allergic reaction. Does anyone have an EpiPen?
A bunch of people gathered around me. While I gasped for air, Dakota raided the makeup. I couldn't see her through the crowd, but I knew she was getting a lot of stuff. She'd shoplifted plenty of times before. I felt a sharp jab against my thigh. I guess someone actually did have an EpiPen. Adrenaline shot through me and I sat straight up. I looked around for Dakota, but she was already gone. Good. Her plan worked. I thanked the guy who had jabbed me. I acted really embarrassed and apologized to the crowd. Then I left the store. Dakota was waiting for me outside, with a bag filled with stolen goodies.
You deserve an Oscar.
She handed me the bag and ran off. I wasn't sure why she left me like that. It wasn't part of the plan. I headed toward my car when I heard someone rush after me.
Ma'am, stop right there!
A security guard was racing after me. I was too shocked to run. He tackled me to the ground, sending the bag flying. All the stolen makeup spilled onto the sidewalk. I was busted. 20 minutes later, I was behind a holding cell. I wasn't hopeless, though. Dakota would come for me. She could talk us out of anything. She had this special talent to get people to believe her. Deep down, I knew she'd come to my rescue. I waited a long time before the door opened and I saw Dakota through the bars. An officer was leading her inside. I felt so happy, so grateful, until she pointed right at me and screamed,
"That's her! She's the thief, officer!"
Why would she say that? She politely asked the officer if she could talk to me privately. I assumed that was against the rules. But like I said, Dakota could convince anyone of anything. He stayed in the room while Dakota approached the bars. She lowered her voice so that only I could hear her.
"Don't worry, I'll pay your bail in a couple days."
A couple days? That meant I missed the fashion show. I knew I should have been worried about my criminal record or about the punishment I was about to face, but all I could think about was that show. My one opportunity to leave this town, and now it was gone. I'd be stuck here forever. And it was all Dakota's fault. That's when I knew she'd planned all this herself. She'd given me the stolen bag. She tipped off the security guard. And now she was refusing to pay my bail until after the fashion show had come and gone. There was only one explanation for why she would ever do something like this.
"You don't want me to leave, do you?"
She held onto the bars and leaned closer until her face was inches away. Her smile was unrecognizable. My mother had warned me about her, but I never listened. It wasn't until that exact moment that I knew Dakota was an absolute psychopath.
"If it makes you feel any better, I really think you would have won."
She blew me a kiss and walked away. True to her word, she paid my bail 2 days later, after the fashion competition had come and gone. Our old classmate Sarah won, and I saw the design she came up with. It was terrible. I haven't talked to Dakota since. It's been 3 months now, and I've ignored all her texts. When I see her in town, I run in the other direction. She wanted to keep me here forever, and she succeeded. But that didn't mean I had to be her friend. We were done. At least that's what I tell myself. One day, I'll probably answer her call. I mean, who else am I going to hang out with? This story is loosely based on a real-world event. In September 2014, an Arkansas woman's obsession with makeup led to her arrest. Brandy Allen, 31, was caught shoplifting at an Ulta Beauty store in Fayetteville after she stuffed $144 worth of eyeshadow into her purse. Police reported that an accomplice tried to distract staff while Allen committed the theft. Store managers detained her until officers arrived and arrested her for shoplifting and disorderly conduct. Allen was booked and later released on an $830 bond.
I had just turned 17 when I got my license, and that new freedom felt like a shot of adrenaline every time I turned the key. Back in high school, we had a habit, me and a few friends, of exploring abandoned places, usually for fun, sometimes for parties. Most were forgettable. Old barns, unfinished basements, once even a dentist's office that still smelled like fluoride. But there was one place that stuck with me. It was a massive, half-built house on the edge of town. I passed it every night driving back from my part-time job at the gas station. The structure looked abandoned, the kind of place with wind-battered tarps flapping in the breeze and a broken fence that didn't bother keeping anyone out. There was something about it. Too big to be left unfinished, too silent to be empty. I told Matt, my best friend and co-conspirator, about it. "You sure no one lives there?" he asked, raising an eyebrow as we cruised down County Line Road one Friday evening. "Positive," I said. "No cars, no lights, just a frame and concrete. Been like that for months." We were killing time before a late movie, and I figured we'd just take a peek. It was summer, dusk was falling, and the cicadas were already humming like warning sirens in the trees. I pulled my rusted-out Corolla into the dirt driveway. The house loomed over us. 3 stories, unfinished roof, blackened window holes like empty sockets. I left my headlights on. We sat there for maybe 10 seconds, long enough to stare at the building and feel that tickle of dread crawling up our backs. Then I backed out, and that's when the truck showed up. It was a beast. Raised suspension, blinding high beams, engine growling like a warning. It pulled in behind us and stuck to our tail like glue. "Dude, who the hell is that?" Matt muttered, twisting in his seat. "I don't know," I said, trying to stay calm, easing toward the main road. "Maybe just someone who lives nearby." But no lights came on in the house. No neighbors peeked out from windows. It was as if the world narrowed to just us and them. At the traffic light, I turned right, heading toward town. The truck didn't follow. Instead, it cut through the gas station on the corner and pulled up sideways, blocking us off. "Shit," I whispered, throwing the car in park. The doors of the truck flung open. Out stepped a man the size of a linebacker, tank top stretched across his chest, neck tattoo barely visible under a thick beard. Beside him, a woman, wild-eyed, stringy blonde hair. There was something feral about her. Matt froze. I kept my hands on the wheel. The man rapped on my window with his knuckle. I rolled it down halfway. "What were you doing back there?" he asked, voice calm but edged with steel. "Just turning around," I lied. "Didn't realize it was private property." The woman stepped in closer. She bent down until her face was inches from mine. "Liar," she whispered. Matt gagged. The man chuckled, grabbed her by the waist. "Cute boys," he said. "Next time you want to snoop, make sure you don't bring lights." He stepped back, motioned for us to move. We didn't argue. Back on the road, Matt finally breathed. "What the fuck was that?" "No clue," I said, my voice hollow. "But that wasn't just some squatter." We went to the movie. We tried to act normal. I couldn't stop thinking about that house. A week later, I went back, alone, parked down the road this time. No lights. Just me, sneakers crunching through the gravel. I cut through the woods at the side and came around the back. What I saw still chills me. There were crates, dozens of them, stacked behind the house, half covered with tarps. I got close enough to see weird labels, some marked medical, others unmarked. I reached for one, peeled the tarp back, and found sealed plastic bags with vials. Strange labels. Foreign script. I didn't touch anything else, just left. I don't go near it anymore. This story is inspired from a real-life incident shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. At 17, fresh with a license, my friends and I used to hunt for abandoned houses to party in. One spot stood out, an unfinished mansion I'd pass on my way home. One evening, before a movie, I took a friend to check it out. It was nearly dark, and we only stopped for a few seconds before leaving. Suddenly, a huge truck appeared behind us, high beams blinding, tailing us aggressively. We tried to ignore it, but it cut through a gas station and blocked our path. A huge guy stepped out and knocked on my window. With no one else around, it felt eerie. He asked what we were doing at the house. I lied and said that we were making a U-turn. He stared at us for a moment, smiled, and let us go. That house is still unfinished. I don't know what goes on there, but I'm convinced it's not legal. I was just heading back from my sister's place in Asheville, the sky already inked out by the time I hit Route 74. I remember adjusting the dial, static, then country, then silence. The road stretched endlessly ahead, the kind of pitch black that makes your own headlights feel like a lie. Mom was driving, her jaw set the way it always was when she was tired but pretending she wasn't. "We'll stop once we hit Canton," she said earlier. "Gas and snacks." I had dozed off in the passenger seat, only to jolt awake when she slammed the brakes so hard my seatbelt locked across my chest. What the hell? I snapped, hard in my throat. There was a man, she said, her voice strangled and thin. He just ran into the road. The figure stood maybe 10 feet from the hood, hunched, like he'd been limping, or pretending to limp. His clothes were torn, blood on his shirt. That's what made Mom hesitate, the blood. She cracked the window a couple inches. Are you okay? She asked, leaning forward. I grabbed her arm. Don't. He didn't answer, just stood there. His shoulders were rising and falling like he'd run a mile, but something was off. The way he didn't look at us. The way he tilted his head slightly, as if listening. Then I saw it. Movement in the trees. To our left and right, shadows broke free from the brush. 3 more men. No flashlights, no sound, just shapes in the dark. Fast, deliberate. They're trying the doors! I yelled. Mom's hand went for the locks just as I heard the clunk of the driver's side handle. Another at mine. They're locked, she whispered, more to herself than me. I locked them. Then the man in front of the car turned, smiled. That's when she floored it. The guy barely jumped aside before the tire screeched and we peeled off, fishtailing once before straightening out. My breath came in ragged gasps, heart hammering. I twisted in my seat, watching the darkness swallow them whole behind us. What the hell was that? I said. Were they trying to rob us? Or worse? I don't know, she muttered, white-knuckling the wheel. I don't know. We drove in silence for what felt like forever. But 20 minutes later, the sign for Canton glowed up ahead. We pulled into a gas station, one of those late-night chain ones that smells like bleach and burnt coffee. Fluorescent lights flickered above. Inside, the cashier looked up from his phone. Skinny guy, beard too big for his face. You folks okay? He asked, maybe noting Mom's shaky hands or my wide eyes. We need the restroom, I said, and some water. He pointed toward the back. I didn't relax until I heard the bolt slide into place on the stall door. When I came out, Mom was waiting in the car, but she hadn't started it yet, just sitting, engine off. I climbed in. Everything good? I think someone followed us. I jerked my head around. What? She didn't answer, just looked into the rear view. I turned too. Nothing but the empty lot and the glowing pumps. You sure? They weren't after the car, she said. They wanted me in the car. I stared at her. What does that even mean? She hesitated. Then she said, I've seen one of those men before. When? 3 months ago. Outside the hardware store in Murphy. He asked for help, said his car broke down. I gave him $20. So he, what, tracked you down for a refund? No. He followed me back then, too. I saw him in my mirror until I got to a police station. I thought it was over. I was quiet for a second. You never told me. Didn't think it mattered, she muttered. Suddenly, the headlights of a semi washed over us. Just a passing truck on the road, but it made my gut twist. Let's just go home, I said. Now. We were back on the highway 5 minutes later. But a mile out of town, the car started jerking. What now? She hissed, pulling over. I popped the door and got out, circling the back. Rear passenger tire was flat. I leaned in, slashed, clean and deliberate. My stomach dropped. They got to us, I said. Back at the gas station, maybe even before. Mom looked around, clutching her phone. No signal here, nothing. Then we heard it, a distant crunch of gravel. We turned, headlights, a small car approaching slow, real slow. No, I whispered. No way. Get in, she snapped. Now! I leapt in, slammed the door. She twisted the key. Nothing. Tried again. Again. Then the light shut off. We were blind. "They're coming," she said. "Glove box." I reached in, pulled out a small pepper spray. Not much, but it was something. Outside, the crunching had stopped. My ears strained. Nothing. Then, bam! Something slammed into the passenger side window. I screamed. Another hit behind me. Then the front windshield. Mom finally got the car roaring to life. We lurched forward on the rim tire, sparks flying. It didn't matter. She didn't stop until we hit a sheriff's substation 10 miles down. They checked the car. Slash marks, fingerprints, but no ID. No security footage from the gas station. No working cameras on that stretch of 74. One of the deputies gave us a long look. "You sure you don't recognize them?" Mom nodded. "Never seen them before in my life." It was a lie. I knew that. She knew I knew. But she had her reasons. That night, as I sat on the motel bed across from her, I asked, "What are you not telling me?" She looked tired, older. Her eyes settled on mine. "I did something," she said slowly, "a long time ago. Something I thought was buried." She didn't elaborate. I didn't push. We left the next morning. Never went back through that road again. Never drove late at night on forest highways. And from then on, we always locked the car the second the engine turned over. Every time.
I just started my new job as a secretary for a mid-sized insurance company, and it wasn't going well. On my first day, I printed out the wrong packet for my boss Jonah's presentation, and he yelled at me in front of everyone. He said that if I made another mistake, I'd be fired. My coworkers told me that he usually wasn't this aggressive. Something must have happened in his personal life. I didn't care what his reason was, though. I didn't want to get on his bad side. For the rest of the week, Jonah watched me like a hawk. It was like he was waiting for me to screw up again. I needed to do something to get on his good side. I noticed that he often picked up Dunkin' Donuts for breakfast, so I decided that I'd go and pick up a dozen donuts for the office as a surprise. So, Friday morning, I got up early and headed to Dunkin' around 6:30. They had just opened, and everything was really fresh. I ordered a dozen, making sure I got a couple maple bars. Those are the ones that Jonah always ordered. The cashier was a young girl who seemed really nice. Her name tag said Hannah. She packed everything up and we talked for a little bit. I told her how stressed I was at my new job, and she commiserated with me. She talked about how she just got out of a pretty bad relationship with a married man, but her life was much better now. As she handed me the order, she noticed the work uniform I was wearing, and her face instantly dropped. "That's where you work?" she asked. It seemed like she knew something that I didn't. But when I asked her what was wrong, she handed me my donuts and told me not to worry. As I walked out of the restaurant, I saw Jonah pulling into the parking lot. I didn't want to ruin the surprise, so I ducked behind a car before he could see me. I watched him walk inside. Then I got in my car and drove straight to the office. Jonah ended up coming in an hour late. By then, most of the donuts had already been eaten, but I made sure to save one of the maple bars, just in case. For some reason, he seemed completely different. He was smiling and whistling to himself, like a huge weight had been lifted off his shoulders. The rest of the workday was pretty uneventful. My donut surprise didn't seem to impress Jonah at all, but he was still in a much better mood than before. He even thanked me when I gave him his mail. That night, I was watching the local news when I saw a report on a murder victim that had been found earlier in the day. They showed a picture of the girl, and it took me a second to recognize that it was Hannah, the girl from the donut shop. They said that her body had been found in a dumpster behind the restaurant. She had been murdered that morning, and the police had no leads. Whoever killed her had shut off the restaurant security cameras. They were asking the public for any witnesses to come forward. I felt absolutely terrible. I might have been one of the last people to see her alive. I remember that Jonah was there, too. Maybe he'd seen something. I thought about telling him that night, but I decided to wait until the morning. When I got to the office the next day, I could see Jonah was just as cheerful as he was the day before. It seemed like a good time to talk to him about Hannah, to see if he had any information that might be able to help the police. It was the two of us alone in his office. I asked him if he saw the news, and he said no. Then I admitted that I had seen him entering Dunkin' Donuts right after me. I asked him if he remembered the woman who was working there. His expression instantly went blank. He knew something about her murder. I tried to ask him what he knew, but he refused to tell me. Instead, he asked if I had talked to police yet. I shook my head no. I didn't have any specific information to give them, but maybe I had seen something important without realizing it. Jonah suggested that we both go to the police station together. I was glad that he seemed to be taking it as seriously as I did. He quickly got out of his chair and marched towards the elevators. I hurried to catch up. He said that we could both take our lunch early and we'd be back within the hour. He still wouldn't say what he knew about Hannah, though. We rode the elevator for a couple floors before I realized that Jonah had pushed the wrong button. We weren't heading to the ground floor. We were headed toward the roof. I asked him what was going on, and he said he just had a short errand to do first. He didn't say anything else. When the elevator door opened, he pulled me out onto the roof before I could push him away. By this point, I could see the insanity in his eyes. He was unhinged. He had just taken me to a place where no one could see or hear us. He reached back into the elevator and pushed all the buttons so that if I tried to go back down, I'd have to wait a long time before the elevator reached us. Jonah looked around to make sure no one else was nearby, and then he finally came clean. He said he'd been seeing Hannah for months. That's why he went to Dunkin' Donuts. Even though he was married, he had fallen madly in love with Hannah. When she rejected him, he couldn't stand it, so he murdered her and disposed of the body. I was disgusted. What he was saying and how he was saying it. He was smiling. He was proud of himself. And as he talked, he slowly stepped closer to me. I had to back away from him. "What are you doing?" I asked. He got even closer, his face inches from mine. "There weren't supposed to be any witnesses," he growled at me. "You killed her?" I asked. He didn't answer, but his dark smile told me everything. He looked proud, triumphant. Then his expression dropped. "I'm so sorry. You were actually one of our best employees." He reached forward, ready to push me off the building. "I wish I'd gotten to know you better," he said. Then he slammed into my chest, expecting me to fall backwards, but I didn't. If he had gotten to know me, he would have known that I had been taking Taekwondo classes for over a decade. At the last second, I grabbed him by the wrists and twisted my body to the side. He didn't have enough time to stop, so without me in front of him, he toppled forward and fell over the edge. After two terrible seconds of silence, I heard him splat on the ground far below. I looked down and saw his body lying dead on the parking lot. His head was twisted all the way around. When the police came, I explained everything step by step. They didn't believe me at first, but when one of the officers unlocked his phone, he saw photos of Jonah and the Dunkin' Donuts girl together. That was the evidence they needed to let me go. Though, they still said they'd call me again if they needed more information. This all happened about a week ago. I'm still at the same company, and without Jonah as my boss, I'm starting to really like my job.